listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Viola's Voice. Poised to star as both Michelle Obama and blues legend Ma Rainey, Viola Davis says the key to a character is discovering what they're fighting for and what holds them back. She talked to Vanity Fair about her own extraordinary journey out of poverty and into the deeply troubling Hollywood system by Sonia Soraya. Photographs by Dario Camese, styled by Elizabeth Stewart. Opening photo, gold standard. Davis was photographed in Culver City, California, with social distancing protocols in place. And this article was in print in Vanity Fair magazine before the release of the Ma Rainey film. During the fraught, emotional days after the killing of George Floyd, Viola Davis wanted more than anything to be out on the streets of Los Angeles, shouting, protesting, holding a sign. She wanted to join the thousands of others who flooded cities across the nation and around the world to call for justice for Floyd and all the other black men and women unjustly killed by the police. She called me and said she was going. Davis's close friend and neighbor, the actor Octavia Spencer, tells me by email. I immediately talked her out of that. Spencer and Davis were both concerned about putting themselves or their loved ones with health conditions at risk, and were acutely aware that due to systemic health care inequality, COVID-19 has a much higher mortality rate for black Americans. Both of us cried, Spencer continues. This was our civil rights movement, and we were sidelined because of health issues. We felt isolated from the movement. Then they had an idea. What about a neighborhood demonstration with friends and family members who needed to be mindful of their health? They banded together with Davis's husband of 17 years, the actor and producer Julius Tenen, fellow actor Yvette Nicole Brown, and a handful of others, and camped out on Laurel Canyon Boulevard in Studio City. They wore masks, which also rendered them unrecognizable. But even so, someone across the street brought them a pizza in a show of solidarity. Davis's sign read simply, Ahmaud Arbery. We said we'd just be out there for a few minutes, and it ended up being hours, hours, Davis tells me a few weeks later from her home in Los Angeles. Almost like a big dam bursting open. She pauses. We got a lot of beeps, she says. We got a few fingers. She means middle fingers, of course. But this was the first time the fingers did not bother me. I ask Davis if she had protested like that before, and with a kind of resignation and pride, she says, I feel like my entire life has been a protest. My production company is my protest. Me not wearing a wig at the Oscars in 2012 was my protest. It is a part of my voice, just like introducing myself to you and saying, Hello, my name is Viola Davis. Let me tell you about that voice. I know you've heard it, but to be enveloped by it, to have it directed at you while she is swaddled in plush black terry cloth, at ease in her kitchen, is spine-tingling. Davis's voice, so much like the stringed instrument she shares a name with, is deeper than you might expect. Resonant, warm, filled with purpose. Her presence radiates even through cyberspace. At times, Davis is delivering a reckoning or a buried history, or a call to arms. Occasionally, she says my name to emphasize a point, and it stops me in my tracks. Has anyone ever said my name before? Has anyone ever taken such care over it? I have no idea what to do with my hands, my face, but I keep assenting, nodding, just trying not to fall behind. Our interview takes place on Juneteenth, a holiday celebrating Black emancipation that has never before had so much mainstream recognition. For a woman who entwines her voice and mission inextricably into her career, it's fitting. Davis, who turns 55 in August, languished in the margins for years before vaulting into the public consciousness in the last decade. In 2015, she became the first Black woman ever to win an Emmy for lead actress in a drama for How to Get Away with Murder, which finished its twisty, unsettling six-season run this spring. In 2017, she won an Oscar for her supporting role as Rose Maxson in Fences, a part for which she also collected a Tony. She will portray Michelle Obama in Showtime's upcoming series, First Ladies, which is being produced by Juvie Productions, the company run by Davis and her husband. Davis lends extraordinary gravity to the roles she plays, a presence both weighty and magnetic. Her performance in The Help as Maid Abilene Clark helps elevate it from apologetic pablum to a sincere examination of the psychological warfare of deep-seated racism. The emotional stakes of the whole movie happen on her face. Davis credits the power of her work to the despair of her impoverished childhood in Central Falls, Rhode Island. The fifth of six children, with an alcoholic and sometimes violent father, the young Viola Davis was often in trouble at school, hungry and unwashed. Her family couldn't always afford laundry and soap, let alone breakfast and dinner. She wet the bed until she was 14 and sometimes went to school stinking of urine. "When I was younger," says Davis, "I did not exert my voice because I did not feel worthy of having a voice." It was the support and affection of people who knew she was worthy that lifted her out of what she calls the hole. Her sisters, Dolores, Diane, and Anita, and her mother, May Alice. "They looked at me and said I was pretty," she says. "Who's telling a dark-skinned girl that she's pretty?" "Nobody says it." "I'm telling you, Sonia, nobody says it." The dark-skinned Black woman's voice is so steeped in slavery and our history. If we did speak up, it would cost us our lives. Somewhere in my cellular memory was still that feeling that I do not have the right to speak up about how I'm being treated, that somehow I deserve it. She pauses. "I did not find my worth on my own." In school, Davis learned the accepted version of American history, which only raised more questions. "I was taught so many things that didn't include me," she says. "Where was I? What were people like me doing?" One summer, when Davis was a teenager, a counselor at Upward Bound heard her and her sister repeating what they'd learned, that the slaves were illiterate. He hauled them to the Rhode Island Black Heritage Society in Providence and showed them microfiche of the Black abolitionist to inspire them. "We sat there for hours and we cried," says Davis. "We cried the entire time." Now, let me tell you about Davis's mind. She insists that she is not at her sharpest at the moment. "For the last 6 years, my brain has been mush because I've been on a TV show," she says. "I used to be a voracious reader." Her brain, to put it very mildly, does not seem like mush. Over the course of our interview, Davis will quote playwrights Arthur Miller and George C. Wolfe, author and professor Brené Brown, existentialist psychiatrist Irvin Yalom, civil rights leader Barbara Jordan, Nuremberg prosecutor Ben Ferencz, monk and theologian Thomas Merton, Aristotle, and on the necessity of using ham hocks when making collard greens, Meryl Streep. Davis does not do small talk. We were only minutes into the interview when she told me that her fundamental need, the root of her being, is to be worthy and valued. It is somewhat disconcerting to converse with someone with so much self-knowledge, and not just self-knowledge, but knowledge. Right now, Davis is reading a book that is opening her mind to her history, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome by Joy DeGruy. Discussing the book, she runs me through an abbreviated history of the oppression of Black Americans, citing the Casual Killing Act and the Protestant ethic on her way to mass incarceration and Black maternal mortality. Having discovered her worth, and she credits theater as well as her mother, sisters, and educators, she clutches it with both hands, refusing to let go. After graduating from Rhode Island College in 1988, Davis went to Juilliard. Her experience was unlike the other students. She celebrated her graduation with what her skimpy funds allowed her, instant ramen and pickled pig's feet. Juilliard has since evolved, she believes, but when she was there, it was a very Eurocentric training. It was the type of school that did not acknowledge my presence in the world. When she graduated from Juilliard in 1993, Davis was deep into James Baldwin, Claude Brown, Nikki Giovanni, and Malcolm X. I was reading everyone at that point, she says, because I was angry. It was then she began to dive into the plays of August Wilson, a voice not acknowledged at school. Davis won a Tony for King Hedley II and received early acclaim for Seven Guitars on Broadway. Her turn as Rose Maxon in Fences is considered definitive, and this year she'll star as legendary blues singer Ma Rainey in the adaptation of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Netflix, as well as executive produce a documentary for the streamer called Giving Voice about high school students competing in a monologue contest based on his plays. He writes for us, Davis says of Wilson. I love August because he lets Black characters talk. A lot of times I don't get to talk, and then sometimes even when I do talk, I'm like, that's not what I would say. She makes a disdainful moue. Set during a recording session in 1927, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom inspires a performance from Davis that's closer to her morally ambiguous lead in How to Get Away with Murder, Annalise Keating, than to the long-suffering Rose Maxon. As Rainey, she's earthy, sweaty, and demanding, her talent nearly outmatched by her ego. Heavyset, gold-toothed, and bisexual, Rainey required a transformation. She was 300 pounds. In Hollywood, that's a lot. Everybody wants to be pretty, so they'll say, ooh, I don't want to be 300 pounds. Can we just ignore that? In my opinion, no. If they say she's 300 pounds, you have to be 300 pounds. Or else you're not honoring her. Davis gained weight and wore padding to approximate Rainey's girth. The hardest part, she says, isn't even the superficial circumstances of a character. It's discovering what they strive for and what holds them back. She quotes a famous passage from Merton's novel, My Argument with the Gestapo. If you want to identify me, ask me not where I live, or what I like to eat, or how I comb my hair, but ask me what I am living for in detail. Ask me what I think is keeping me from living fully for the thing I want to live for. For Davis, this is both life advice and acting credo. It's always something basic, she says, at the heart of every individual, every character, but it's the hardest element to isolate. Sometimes I skip it, she says dryly. I say, maybe I'll get the revelation later. For Rainey, she says, it's about being respected. At one point, in a fit of pique, Rainey asks for 3 Coca-Colas and won't perform or cooperate until she gets them. Noisily, she glugs them down while the white agent, white producer, and her Black band wait. It's infuriating, but also totally badass. Partway through our conversation, Davis lifts her screen and carries me from her dazzling white kitchen to a more secluded office. I float past a wall covered in framed pictures. High ceilings, mansion comfort. "Here's the thing," she told the New Yorker in 2016. "Because I grew up in such tight spaces, I don't get manicures, pedicures. I'm not into cars, but I am into a fabulous house." Davis has changed locations because Tinan, her husband, began loading the dishwasher. I didn't get to say hello, but I did see his arm and the open, affectionate look on her face when Davis turned toward him. "We are a loud family," she tells me as she settles into her office. She says that if her daughter Genesis were there, she would absolutely want to say hello. The 10-year-old appeared in her first movie, The Angry Birds Movie 2, last year. The office is one big trophy case, with Davis's many awards crowded along one wall. Davis does not like the room. As soon as I go in there, my anxiety goes up. So she's facing away from the statuettes, focusing instead on a photo of her and Streep on the set of 2008's Doubt. Though Davis had made a name for herself on Broadway, Doubt was her mainstream breakthrough, a 7-minute performance that ended up snagging her an Oscar nomination. Streep, during her own awards run for the movie, championed her scene partner, crying out at one point, "Somebody, give her a movie." "What do you call someone who shares your belief system?" Davis asked me. "She is in my tribe, Meryl is." Streep's career galvanizes Davis. In an industry that prizes ingenues, both actors have made a mark playing meaty, complex, mature women, though Davis didn't have the benefit of the first 20 years of Streep's career, with roles designed to showcase her gifts. At this point, with a production company of her own, Davis knows she can find work. What concerns her are the black actresses who are younger and fighting not to be invisible, the earlier versions of who she was. There's not enough opportunities out there to bring that unknown, faceless black actress to the ranks of the known, to pop her. She names other performers, Emma Stone, Reese Witherspoon, Kristen Stewart, all fabulous white actresses who have had a wonderful role for each stage of their lives that brought them to the stage they are now. We can't say that for many actors of color. Davis took her part as Abilene in The Help because she herself was hoping to pop. I was that journeyman actor, trying to get in. The film became a nationwide sensation and nabbed her another Oscar nomination, but its reductive view of race relations troubled many critics. In 2018, Davis told the New York Times that she regretted taking the role. She still does. Even though The Help recently became the most viewed film on Netflix. Davis is effusive in her praise of writer-director Tate Taylor, who is white, and the majority female cast. "I cannot tell you the love I have for these women and the love they have for me," she says. "But with any movie, are people ready for the truth?" The Help was filmed partly in Greenwood, Mississippi, and Davis was acutely conscious of the area's racist roots. Emmett Till was tortured and killed a few miles away in Money, and the first White Citizens Council was said to be founded in nearby Indianola. The film reaches toward the tragedy of Abilene's story, then rapidly undermines its own high stakes, turning racism into a social farce. "Not a lot of narratives are also invested in our humanity," says Davis. "They're invested in the idea of what it means to be black, but it's catering to the white audience. The white audience, at the most, can sit and get an academic lesson into how we are. Then they leave the movie theater and they talk about what it meant. They're not moved by who we were." Here, Davis references the power of Wilson's work versus what she calls watered-down material. She points to To Kill a Mockingbird, recently revived as a stage play by Aaron Sorkin on Broadway. "It's beloved for good reason," she says, But Atticus Finch was the hero. Tom Robinson was slaughtered and killed in a prison for something he did not do. She laughs, the humor of disorientation, frustration, disbelief. He's not the hero. There's no one who's not entertained by the help, but there's a part of me that feels like I betrayed myself and my people because I was in a movie that wasn't ready to tell the whole truth, Davis says. The help, like so many other movies, was created in the filter and the cesspool of systemic racism. And astoundingly, while The Help raised her profile, it did not open the floodgates to more substantive acting roles. People sometimes ask Davis why she did network TV for 6 years when she had a movie career. I always ask them, what movies? What were those movies? She says with an incredulous shake of her head. Listen, I got Widows, the 2018 action thriller about a team of women who plan a heist. But if I just relied on the Hollywood pipeline, no, there are not those roles. Widows director Steve McQueen agrees. The main point for me, he tells me, unprompted, is that she needs to play more characters on film. She has got to be given more attention. He cannot contain his praise for Davis's talent. She goes where others dare not tread. She's not afraid to be human, adding, she hasn't been given her due. That's a fact. But Davis has worked wonders with the opportunities she's been afforded, to say the least. Viola is one of the great actors of all time, not just her time, says Denzel Washington, who produced Fences and Ma Rainey, while also directing and starring in the former. She's been recognized, obviously not too late, but later than some. But she's gone farther than most. So, you know, which would you prefer? Some people get the opportunity early, and they're done by Tuesday. With the hashtag MeToo movement, Hollywood has taken up the cause of sexual harassment and pay discrepancy, highlighting how differently the industry treats men and women. But commenting on harassment and money is still especially fraught for black talent, says Davis. We know as women, when you speak up, you're labeled a bitch, immediately, unruly, immediately. Just as a woman of color, there is very, very, very little you have to do. All you have to do is maybe roll your eyes, and that's it. In moments like that, she feels that post-traumatic slave syndrome once again. Negro, you do as I say, when I tell you to do it. Later she'll tell me, if there is a place that is a metaphor for just fitting in and squelching your own authentic voice, Hollywood would be the place. With the caveat that when we talk about our pay as celebrities, it gets almost obnoxious. 50% of Americans make $30,000 or less. Davis mentions an old news report in which a female performer making $420,000 per episode for a TV show was frustrated to find that her male co-star was commanding $500,000. She appears to be referring to House of Cards stars Robin Wright and Kevin Spacey. But there was a similar story about Ellen Pompeo and Patrick Dempsey of Grey's Anatomy. The discrepancy was wrong, Davis says, but how I saw it was, she drops her voice an octave, you're making $420,000 per episode? Me, Taraji P. Henson, Kerry Washington, Issa Rae, Gabrielle Union, we're number one on the call sheet. Not speaking out is unthinkable for Davis. Her voice is her identity, her emancipation. It's still daunting, though. Should I say it? Should I not? What's a good hashtag? Is there going to be some kind of silent backlash where I just stop getting phone calls, stop getting jobs? And as if those questions aren't formidable enough, here's another. How could Davis ever address everything that demands addressing when racism in this country is both subtle and systemic? I've watched Davis do video interviews with white men like Tom Hanks in Variety's Actors on Actors series, and black women like Oprah Winfrey for OWN. The difference is remarkable. Of course, Davis is a skilled code switcher. She'd have to be. But her openness in Winfrey's presence is markedly different to the glassy, careful facade she maintains around Hanks, who, for whatever reason, and maybe it's just excitement or inexperience as an interviewer, constantly interrupts her. Davis brings up Vanity Fair's own history of inclusiveness, or lack thereof, and fair enough. They've had a problem in the past with putting black women on the covers, she says. But that's a lot of magazines. That's a lot of beauty campaigns. There's a real absence of dark-skinned black women. When you couple that with what's going on in our culture and how they treat black women, you have a double whammy. You are putting us in a complete cloak of invisibility. She agreed to star as Annalise in How to Get Away with Murder, as well as serve as a producer to try to reshape and expand the Overton window for black women, to make moral ambiguity, bisexuality, and wigless, makeup-free grief part of the conversation. This year, in the New York Times, filmmaker and journalist Kelly Terrell described Annalise as a pop culture revelation and one of the most complicated black women in television history. Still, an earlier Times piece lingers like a toxic cloud. In 2014, critic Alessandra Stanley prompted a backlash with her review of the show, describing executive producer Shonda Rhimes as an angry black woman, and proclaiming jaw-droppingly that Davis was less classically beautiful than Kerry Washington. Davis isn't furious about the Times piece, but neither will she dismiss it as a random or meaningless event. Whatever her name is from the New York Times, just write a review. She has to pause here because I am laughing. In not just writing a review, you have revealed your own underlying racism. All you see is a black woman. That's it. You don't see a woman. Davis draws strength from both the black women who made a path for her and the little girls like her daughter following in her footsteps. We have survived a hellified history. People share their stories with me a lot, she continues. I nod to her over Zoom. Of course they do. People hug me in grocery stores, parking lots, at Target. Stores like Target and Vons, she adds, are her happy place. When I consider the little girl she once was, it makes sense. They're pristine, fluorescent landscapes of the semi-affordable trappings of human dignity, a little grocery, a little fashion, a little decor. As with many of us, the pandemic has given Davis a taste of a slower life. I don't put any limits on myself, she says, but I feel the disillusionment of being busy. My work is not all of me. She pauses, then adds with suppressed mirth, I used to say when I was younger, acting is not what I do, it's who I am. I look back at myself like, what the hell were you talking about? She laughs her bell-like laugh. I think I understand. Acting helped her find her voice, but she has discovered that her worth transcends her talent. To the world, she's a warrior, says Octavia Spencer. To those of us who love her, she's simply our sister.
Thank you.
Avedon Ascendant. Making his name in the fashion world, the legendary portraitist Richard Avedon came of age artistically and sexually in the high bohemia of the 1940s and 50s. Biographer Philip Gefter asserts that the photographer and his creative contemporaries were forecasting the future of the culture and the modern American woman. Photographs by Lillian Bassman and Paul Himmel. Opening photo, Bright Young Things, Doe and Dick Avedon on the Fire Island Dunes. This article is adapted from What Becomes a Legend Most, the biography of Richard Avedon by Philip Gefter, copyright 2020 by Philip Gefter, reprinted by permission of Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. Richard Avedon and his young wife, Doe, had no idea what they were getting into when they agreed to take a beach house share in the summer of 1946 with his boss at Harper's Bazaar, Lillian Bassman, and her husband, photographer Paul Himmel, in Cherry Grove, a community of bohemian intellectuals on Fire Island, 90 minutes outside of New York City. The slender barrier island, dotted with scrub and brush and dunes, was reachable only by public ferry or private boat. Cars were not allowed. During the day, when the sun was out, the shimmering reflections on the ocean to the south and the glassy waters of the Great South Bay to the north created a unique and astonishing kind of light. That summer was a fertile one for Dick, as everyone called Avedon, barely 23, fresh out of the merchant marine, and already absorbing the enormous benefits of his new friendship with his housemates. Bassman, under the tutelage of the legendary design eminence Alexei Brodovich, was the art director of Junior Bazaar, with whom Avedon was now working regularly. Himmel was a talented photographer who also had studied with Brodovich. The two couples occupied a bare-bones cottage with no electricity or running water. They used kerosene lamps for light and pumped water from a well to wash their dishes and flush the outhouse toilet. And yet the absence of modern creature comforts hardly mattered. In a way, the circumstances of Dick's new professional life at Harper's Bazaar had echoed his home life. Brodovich was a dictatorial father figure. Carmel Snow, the magazine's editor-in-chief, was as spirited and attentive as Avedon's mother. Lillian and Paul, meanwhile, unconventional, provocative, and culturally alert, provided more than an ample surrogate for Avedon's close cousin, Margie, who, throughout his childhood, had been a precocious and cheeky co-conspirator. Both Bassman and Himmel would turn out to be of enormous influence on Avedon, professionally and emotionally. Dick was now ensconced in an entirely new kind of symbiosis of work and play that challenged him with a set of growing pains tantamount to a cultural repubescence. Dick and Doe would take the train out on weekends and have dinner with Lily and Paul at the hotel, the only place in Cherry Grove with electricity and running water. The Stinger was a favorite drink, brandy and creme de menthe, a good, stiff knockout drink, Bassman said. They would eat and drink and laugh and dance barefoot until 3 or 4 in the morning, the Lindy, the Tango, One Steps, and then go swimming in the ocean. Dick was amazing, Lillian said about Avedon's Friday night arrivals. He would be so hyper that he would order 2 dinners and go right through them. It was an extraordinary kind of hypertension, I guess, really joyful and fun, but at the same time, something else was going on inside him. Her implication was that Dick was now confronting not only the rigors of his new working life, but also a host of personal issues of a darker, more complicated psychological and sexual tenor. It became clear to the Bassman Himmels soon enough that Dick's relationship with Doe was one of romantic affection, but not of physical passion. And Cherry Grove offered temptations that were exotic and deeply thrilling, yet for Dick, ultimately terrifying. Paul and I were free spirits, and there were dunes, Bassman said, explaining that she and Paul would lie around naked, sometimes alone, sometimes with other friends, and everybody would run down to the water with abandon and swim. She remembers Dick and Doe being shy and abashed, taking almost half the summer before they felt comfortable enough to shed their inhibitions and finally most of their clothes. I still have pictures of them, at least in my head, Dick and Doe running down the beach in their jeans, looking like two boys, arms around each other. She was a beautiful girl and not masculine in any way, but they were both slim and young, looking like brother and sister. Next photos, suddenly that summer, the Avedons clamming and lounging with housemate Paul Himmel. Lillian Bassman, beachside with the Avedons. Dick and Doe on the Fire Island Ferry. Cherry Grove attracted artists, writers, actors, and young theater producers, a place where conventional rules and mainstream thinking was actively, if theatrically, derided. It was a place where every stanza of the Cole Porter song Anything Goes, written in the previous decade, would make a suitable anthem. The artist collective Pajama, for example, which consisted of the painter Paul Cadmus, who was the lover of Jared French, and French's wife Margaret Haining, Pajama, deriving from the first two letters of their first names, along with another menage a trois, George Platt Lines, Monroe Wheeler, and Glenway Westcott, spent many summers in the nearby Fire Island community of Saltaire. Lines was for years a photographer at Vogue, and thought to be in contemporary parlance the quintessential urbane gay man of his era. He lived in a closeted bubble of privilege, protected by a traditionally stylish public veneer, surrounding himself with a group of artists, writers, and attractive dancers from the New York City Ballet, co-founded by his friend Lincoln Kirsten. He regularly hosted parties in his Park Avenue apartment, reputed to be as elegant as they were orgiastic. Lines would make many photographs of Pajama at Cherry Grove, some of them posing in the nude, positioned against the architectural framework of the lifeguard stands along the beach. "We walked to Cherry Grove when the sand was hard," Cadmus remembered. "We go to check out the gay life there." Westcott, the poet and novelist, offered this glimpse of the scene in his journal. "Just beyond these bungalows, just over the dunes, there lies heavenly landscape, sandscape, with delights of the flesh and the weather more selfish than anything in the world. Friday night, when we arrived, they took me down to the beach. The harvest moon had just risen. It seemed to have come up terribly excited, like a bull into an arena." Bassman described Cherry Grove as a very gay community, but at that time also very literary, you know, a lot of producers and directors and poets, Auden, people like that. Dick would soon photograph W.H. Auden at his house in Cherry Grove, where Auden's good friend Christopher Isherwood, author of the Berlin stories, would sometimes visit. The artist Pavel Tchetchiou had a house there with his lover, Charles-Henri Ford. Janet Flanner summered there, as did Benjamin Britten and his lover, Peter Pears. Writer Truman Capote was a regular visitor, as was playwright Tennessee Williams. Next photos, Fire Island in focus, at Duffy's Hotel Bar, Cherry Grove. Ford model Natalie Nickerson on Avedon's first Harper's Bazaar cover, January 1947, epitomized the photographer's vision of the modern woman. A late 1940s Himmel portrait of a 20-something Avedon exuding confidence and sensual allure. Among the weekend guests who stayed with Dick and Doe and Lily and Paul were the photographer Carl Bissinger, whose romantic partner Johnny Nicholson would open Café Nicholson on East 58th Street in the city, which became a popular gathering spot for the so-called New Bohemians, including Williams, Tannehill Leclerc, Donald Wyndham, Buffy Johnson, and Gore Vidal, the group famously documented in an alfresco photograph for Flair magazine. Leonard Gersh, a young playwright whom Dick got to know while in the Merchant Marine, shared the house with them one summer. He would go on to write a play called Wedding Day, modeled on the Avedons, that would become the 1957 hit movie Funny Face, starring Fred Astaire as Dick Avery and Audrey Hepburn, a sometime Avedon model, as Jo, based on Doe. William Alexander MacDonald III, a decorator, would come out and stay too. As Bassman recalled, he always made champagne eggs on the kerosene stove. While Lily was technically Dick's boss, it was through their natural rapport and playful collaboration that she was able to coax out of him fresh, and original visual solutions to their editorial problems. Her husband, Paul, also photographed over the years for Bazaar and Vogue and brought a different set of winning, if at times brooding, qualities to the evolution of the friendship between the two couples. Paul was literary, political, and witty. "My dad was killer sarcasm," Lizzie Himmel said. "He was an amazing speaker and teller of stories. He was handsome, too, almost dandyish, working out on a daily basis to keep his body in excellent shape. His sexuality was, say, fluid, and he seemed perfectly comfortable about it, which might have added to Dick's conflicted feelings about the lure of same-sex attraction in that environment." "My father was way less gay-shy than Dick was," Lizzie said. "I think that Dick was wildly in love with my mother, but I think he was very attracted to my father." Bassman, who was then 29, and Himmel, 3 years older, had both grown up in politically progressive families in which atheism and communism, respectively, gave them an existential resolve about living life in the present, as well as an egalitarian sense of justice. Lillian studied art at Pratt Institute and would eventually become a consequential fashion photographer. Paul's sultry photographs of city life exploited the romance of dark shadows, watery reflections, and patterns of light in a way that was consistent with his contemporary Saul Leiter and Louis Farrar. Lillian and Paul struck an unselfconscious posture of enlightened irreverence that Dick simultaneously reveled in and shied away from. For Joe, by contrast, an aspiring actor who had several modest roles on Broadway, their uninhibited nature seemed more compatible with her own. According to Lizzie, her parents were, by turns, intellectual, discriminating, political, artistic, original, and ultimately restless. Her brother Eric corroborates, "Finally, inevitably, it was a worldview, a way of looking out at others that could seem infuriatingly smug to outsiders, but had undeniable strength, valuing above all else creativity, productivity, and unconventionality." "It was the beginning of a great relationship," Bassman said about the Avedons, describing how close the four of them were during those years and how much fun the two couples had together, sitting on the beach all day, swimming nude, playing chess or charades at night, while they drank, partying all the time. Dick and Lillian also spent some of their time in Cherry Grove, as if it were an ongoing editorial meeting. They would dream up fashion features, generating much of the content for Junior Bazaar, since, in the new post-war era, there was not yet a burgeoning fashion industry to draw ideas from. They would talk about the magazine, how they would produce features, which models and designers they would use, and what the general viewpoint would be. "One time," she remembered, "sitting on the beach, Dick and I planned a whole issue around green. Green vegetables, green nail polish, green clothing. So we sent the fashion editors out to find things that were green. We sent the beauty people out to get green nail polish made, and I made a layout with these wonderful drawings of vegetables." Then Dick photographed all the girls and made it look like they were climbing through these fruits. Lily and Paul made many casual pictures of Dick and Doe during their summers in Cherry Grove. In some, Dick looked scrawny, with gawky features, an awkward stance, and what were considered then to be feminized gestures. Doe had distinct and beautiful features and such a poised manner that her entire affect is one of comfort and ease in her body. Some pictures capture the pair sweetly affectionate and happily entwined, while in others Dick looks so young and almost frail in comparison to the buoyant, demonstrative Doe that it's hard to imagine the two of them as a natural match. Yet in one casual portrait Paul made of Dick alone, he looks far more grown up and self-assured, quite handsome and virile, his features filling out the structure of his face, his eyes opened wide, his gaze deep and liquid, his lips sculptural and sensual. There is a distinct eroticism to the portrait, yet it is unclear whether it derives from amorous feelings in Himmel or from Avedon's honest gaze at the camera. Regardless, the connection between them is palpable. In this picture, Dick, formerly geeky and ill at ease, seems to be actively willing the handsome good looks he is growing into. At Harper's Bazaar, Dick still felt that he had to prove his indispensability in every single issue. He measured himself against the already impossible professional standards of excellence at the magazine and brought an acute sensitivity to everything around him. He was overly excitable in his enthusiasms, and equally he catastrophized the simplest slight. His ambition, though, fueled a growing restlessness about his career, and his elbow, as Brodovich referred to his single-minded pursuit of his work, could be sharpened by the whiff of competition. As he was spending weekends at the beach that first summer, for example, it seemed to irk him that Truman Capote was on assignment in New Orleans with the photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson for a bizarre feature called Notes on N.O. Of course, at Cherry Grove, Avedon was also absorbing an entirely new way of being, and the stimulus was overwhelming. He was meeting people unlike any he had known before, and observing behavior that came from a new set of attitudes and ideas about how to construct a life. In that community, he was forced to navigate the open physical affection of men, and consequently confront a profound shame about his own fascination, perhaps specifically with Paul. It was a kind of desire that had no place in La Façade Avedon with which he intended to earn professional respect, gain cultural standing, and establish financial security. Dick's driving ambition propelled him to outwardly ignore these subterranean impulses, or at least to try to suppress what he feared would become professional impediments. Being openly gay would prove not to be a career obstacle for several of his close friends in the arts, such as Capote, composer Leonard Bernstein, and writer James Baldwin, with whom Avedon had co-edited their high school literary journal. Yet Dick had been conditioned to thwart his desires, not only because of the expectations of his stern father, but also as a necessary survival measure in a society hostile to gays. Newspapers reported the arrest of gay and lesbian sexual deviants, or perverts, as they were often labeled, mentioning them by name, ruining their careers, destroying their lives. Since World War II, in fact, gay soldiers had been expelled from the armed forces, losing access to jobs and federal benefits due to their having been dishonorably discharged. Without question, the cultural incentive for Dick to marry had been overwhelming. There was a war going on inside him. The young Avedon had been an award-winning poet and practiced dance before turning to photography, and his finely tuned responsiveness to the sensate world all around him was in conflict with the censor's rejection of perhaps the deepest source of that sensitivity. I must tell you that we artists cannot tread the path of beauty without Eros keeping company with us and appointing himself as our guide, writes Thomas Mann in Death in Venice. Somewhere within that conflict, Dick was able to locate inspiration to create his first cover of Harper's Bazaar, published in January 1947. The picture must have drawn direct inspiration from Avedon's first summer in Cherry Grove, as it conjures a beach scene without hiding the fact that it was taken in the studio. The model Natalie Nickerson faces the camera straight on, head to toe, blonde hair pulled tight behind her head, a slight impish smile on her face, a small scarf wrapped around her neck, the sleeves of her dark sweater pulled up to her elbows, bare legs spread apart in pastel short shorts, and her bare feet planted firmly on the sand-colored floor. Behind her is a man in a bathing suit reclining, his back to the camera, his elbow propping him up, staring out at the horizon and the infinite ocean. Some people claim the male figure to be Avedon himself. The model doesn't seem to care that the man's attention is elsewhere. She has plenty going for her without his acknowledgement. Her triangular silhouette is cast in relief against the uncluttered white, seamless background, lit to suggest the glare of the sun. Dick's first cover for the magazine introduces what will long become identified as the Avedon woman, slender, androgynous, natural, spontaneous, spirited, and self-conscious, a bit kooky, and utterly self-assured. With his cover debut, Dick seemed to have been incorporating the new set of social conditions introduced to him on Fire Island into a visual representation that is dramatically contemporary. In post-war America, this fashion picture was utterly radical for its visual simplicity, its unconventionality, and ultimately its depiction of a thoroughly independent woman. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.